You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
My name is Jeff Lipton, and I'm here with a close colleague and friend, Dr. Jorge Cortez. I'm at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center in Toronto, and Jorge's at the Georgia Cancer Center in Augusta, Georgia. And we're here to do a podcast sponsored by Pfizer on using bosutinib safely in the treatment of CML. As I mentioned, Jorge's in Georgia, I'm in Toronto, and we're going to talk socially and discussing a lot of the issues, primarily based not so much on using bosutinib and its efficacy, but how to use it safely and continue people on the drug on a regular basis. So with that in mind, I'd like to introduce Jorge to give this part.
Hey, Jeff, thank you for the introduction, and thank you for having me here. So, you know, I think that first we can start talking about the data that we have. There's probably three main studies that are worth basing the discussion around. One is the frontline study, the before study. You remember that's that randomized study of bosutinib versus imatinib as initial therapy. And then two of the later lines of therapy, the original study that's called the study 200, that was for patients who had received prior therapy, largely with imatinib. That was the biggest cohort. There were some patients that had received also dasatinib or nilotinib. Those cohorts were added a little later. And then the beyond study, a more recent study, mostly European, in patients with prior therapies. And they included second, third, fourth line and beyond. So I think that the important thing, that there's a few highlights, and I think they apply to the three studies. One is that the durability of the responses, largely the patients who get a response with bosutinib, as with all the TKIs, of course, those responses tend to be very durable. And we've seen in the frontline setting that the response rate is high. There's deep molecular responses. It reaches over 50% of patients who get to MR 4.5, and most of them tend to be sustained deep molecular responses. That's important because those are the patients that we can consider for treatment discontinuation. And in the study 200, we do get the responses. The primary endpoint in that study was major cytogenetic responses for different times, but they tend to be very durable. But the other thing that's important to remember is that you reach a plateau. You know, there's a point where you've reached as much as you're going to get. Now, some patients may not reach an MR 4.5. They reach an MMR. In my book, that's good. So certainly, those patients cannot discontinue therapy, but that's a conversation with the patient, you know, because a major molecular response is a perfectly okay response to me if the patient is not particularly looking for treatment discontinuation. The interesting thing about the Beyond study, in my opinion, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, is the response rates were much higher than in the study 200. I think there's a couple of reasons why. One is that there was a significant number of patients that were intolerant rather than resistant. So we know that those patients respond better. But also, I think it's some of what we've learned about managing the drug, which I think is very important. And you mentioned in your introduction that those are some of the things that we need to discuss because they are very, very important. So those are kind of my takes on the data and what it means in our practice. I'd love to hear your thoughts, Jeff.
Well, I think that's really a major issue. Is I don't think anybody has ever had queries about the efficacy of the drug, as many studies have showed, but some of the early studies showed a fair bit of toxicity, which caused some discontinuation and even negated the very first study that was done with the drug in first line called the Bella, because I think the dose that was chosen was high. I think once you get over the first hump with this drug, it becomes an extremely safe drug, good for long-term use, not a lot of long-term side effects. And compared to some of the other second-generation TKIs, and it makes it very easy to use. So I think patients who get over it, those that initial hump, and get on the dose of the drug, many of whom are using doses of the drug less than is actually on the product monograph, do extremely well and quite enjoy the drug. Mm-hmm. And I think it becomes something very useful. I agree with what you said about picking your patients, which is always the problem of some of the studies of The Beyond study showed some wonderful results, but again, many of those were intolerant patients rather than resistant patients, and that does make a difference. So, how would you go about selecting a patient for bosutinib? Let us maybe give me a few minutes on first line, and then where you would use it in salvage therapy.
Well, in the first line of therapy, that's a drug that I like a lot. I generally favor using a second generation TKI over imatinib for most of my patients. Why? Because I do value those deep molecular responses. Sometimes there's the argument that, well, they don't improve survival. Well, no, with imatinib, you've already reached near normal life expectancy. So now we're looking beyond just the survival benefit. And so I prefer a second generation TKI, and bosutinib has among the second generation TKI the lowest risk of arterial occlusive events, heart attacks and strokes and those kind of things. So with that in mind, it tends to be my go-to drug in most patients. Sure, diarrhea is common, you mentioned that, but the diarrhea is manageable, and if I manage it well, and if I help my patients, I think this is, most patients do it very well. So, if I have a patient that already has gastrointestinal issues, an irritable bowel syndrome or something like that, no, I'm not going to give them bosutinib because they're more likely to have these issues, and I do have other options. So, that's kind of how I see that selection. In subsequent lines of therapy. And let's talk about second line. Second line after imatinib is a little bit easier because we have second generation TKIs. Again, I like bosutinib a lot because of the safety profile. Efficacy-wise, I think that both in the front line and in the subsequent lines of therapy, they're equivalent. The second generation TKIs are fairly equivalent. I don't think there's a big difference. And there's actually this randomized study front line from Japan. It's dasatinib versus nilotinib, but they're completely identical. And I think if we added bosutinib, that'll be the same. It's the efficacy, the safety profile that makes the difference. So going back to the second line, if you have mutations, that can guide you. But the reality is that mutations are present and informative in only a small subset of patients. So for the most part, you have to select based on things like comorbidities and risk of adverse events and schedule of administration and those kind of things. So, bosutinib, I like it's once a day, the same as dasatinib. I decide based on, again, what expected side effects and the characteristics of the patient and so on. It's a little bit more difficult in patients that have had a second generation TKI as initial therapy, and you have resistance in particular, because then we don't have much data as to what to use next. Again, second generation TKIs, they are equivalent, so it's not a great choice. You can go to either ponatinib or asciminib in those instances. That's kind of what I prefer to do in those circumstances. Third line, of course, ponatinib and asciminib. Now, there is some good data with bosutinib. It's the only second generation TKI that has prospective data as third line therapy. And it does have some efficacy. I think, unquestionably, ponatinib and asciminib have better response rates. There may be an occasional patient where bosutinib may be preferred for some reason, but I think there you're looking more at the later lines of therapy.
I think you make some interesting points. And one is in the absence, with a resistant patient, in the absence of mutation directions, the chances of a second generation working after another second generation is not that good. As you said, there's some data with bosutinib, and people could try it if they want in third line after another second generation. But you'll know within 3 months if you're going to get a response. So if you're going to try it, sure. But if you're not getting a response by 3 months, I agree totally with you about moving on to ponatinib or asciminib. The one question I'm going to ask you is there any particular side effects that you may have seen with another drug that would prevent you from using bosutinib? Let's forget the comorbidities. I think we can go over that. But are there some kind of other side effects, for instance, you've had with imatinib or one of the other second generations, that would suggest that everything else being equal, bosutinib might not be your best choice?
It's hard to tell because Well, you mentioned, I mentioned the comorbidities and patient that has history of GI problems and so on. Otherwise, you know, I like the schedule of administration. In that regard, to me, the easiest ones to administer are dasatinib and bosutinib because they're only once a day. The bosutinib is with food. The dasatinib is with or without food. But with food is simple. It don't have to be a full meal, and that's important to educate the patients about. But you know, in general, I think that any patient is seems to be to me a reasonable patient, aside from those with history of gastrointestinal syndromes. Now, myelosuppression is a common problem. So if the patient has had myelosuppression before, you are more likely to have cross intolerance with that. And thrombocytopenia seems to be very similar across the different TKIs. Neutropenia is a little bit less with bosutinib. The other TKIs, the reported grade 3, grade 4, is about 25 to 30%. With bosutinib, is more in the teens. Let's remember, it doesn't have a KIT inhibition, and that may explain that slightly lower rate of neutropenia. So for those patients, that may be a preferred option. Thrombocytopenias, the patients that have persistent thrombocytopenias with one TKI, whatever that TKI is, that tends to be recurrent with the next TKI, whatever that TKI is.
Yeah, you generally have marrow suppression of normal marrow, which doesn't recover. I guess the only thing that bears watching, I'm not sure necessarily negates the use of bosutinib, is if you're actually moving a patient on because of recurrent pleural effusions in dasatinib, there may be a slightly higher incidence of seeing that with bosutinib, although pleural effusions are seen with all the drugs in various amounts. There's some literature that says that you might have a slightly higher incidence with bosutinib after dasatinib, and these patients require more careful monitoring for this kind of an event and some care there. But that, otherwise, I agree with you entirely.
That's a good point. I agree with that. And that's been my observation. Without prior exposure to dasatinib, it's not common with bosutinib. But when there's been prior exposure to dasatinib, I agree that bosutinib probably gives you more than others. So, yeah, good point.
And I guess we have some data out there as well as the quality of life that patients have while on bosutinib. Would you care to comment on that at all?
Yeah, I think that what we've seen is that the quality of life is maintained, in some areas improved, in others maintained. One particular aspect of the quality of life that I like and I like to emphasize is that in the before study, in the randomized versus imatinib, the diarrhea was more common with bosutinib. Now, imatinib had about a 60%, bosutinib is more like in the 80-85%. But the impact on quality of life was greater for the patients that had diarrhea with imatinib than for the patients who had diarrhea with bosutinib. The characteristics of the diarrhea are different. It was more uncomfortable for patients with the diarrhea from imatinib. So that is important because you mentioned earlier that the frequency of the diarrhea kind of makes many colleagues feel uncomfortable prescribing bosutinib, yet it's a very manageable diarrhea, and the impact on quality of life is much less, just because it tends to be very transient, both in terms of being in the early weeks of therapy and then it gets better, and transient also in the sense of that most patients, at least my experience, is that they tell me, you know, I take my pill, after half an hour, I have to use the restroom, then I'm okay. So it tends to be kind of like a quick, and they can adjust it to their lifestyle so that it doesn't occur in you know, during, I don't know, work or travel or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's something I think we could get into is number one, the things like the dosing impact on the diarrhea. But I think I agree entirely. One of the things I found with bosutinib, it tends to be a transient diarrhea that occurs very early in starting the drug and often goes away, whereas the diarrhea with the imatinib, for instance, is chronic. It is a problem that is there indefinitely as long as someone's using it and can be a major issue. So I think that is a big difference. So I think we discussed some of the issues. So why don't I think we get into how we can manage some of these toxicities and what the impact of some of the studies have done that have shown ways to avoid it. I think one of the things we've learned is by lower doses tend to have better effects. We've learned that when with a lot of the efficacy data, we've never had to use the full dose of bosutinib. Either would salvage at 500 or frontline at 400. Many patients do better on a much lower dose. And that's allowed us to do a number of things. Is number one, the whole, what I like to call a ramping up phenomenon, is you don't need to start the drug at the full dose. And sometimes you can start as low as even 100 milligrams a day and ramp it up every few days to a week, depending on symptoms. And that often reduces the impact of the side effect and maybe impact reduces how severe it is. Comments on that? And are you seeing much the same thing?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, it's interesting because when we started using TKIs in general, we were very fixated on the dosing issue, and we wanted to use full dose all the time, keep it going, and all of that. And then I think little by little, out of necessity and playing a little bit with what we had seen and experienced, many of us started doing this ramping up that you say, starting lower and let the patients ease into those few weeks of the diarrhea, and definitely helped. You know, many patients felt better. And there was this study that made these more formally studied by Fausto Castagnetti, where we intentionally did that in a prospective way. And this was for mostly older patients. And he started with 200 milligrams 2 weeks, then went to 300 milligrams. And then depending on the response, if they were responding well by 3 months, then he stayed there. If not, he went up to 400. And with that, not only was the tolerability much better, but also the efficacy was very good because there was much less treatment interruptions and so on. So I think that now we've realized that the label dose does not mean that you have to just stick to that no matter what. We can help the patients get into that. And I think that particularly with bosutinib, that ramping up of the dose is very beneficial, mostly for the GI toxicity, although I do think it helps also in some ways for the hematologic toxicity. You may see a little bit less of that. So I think that for most patients, I use it. If it's a refractory patient that has very active disease and I'm very worried, I may go straight to the full dose. But in many instances, I think that allows me to get better management of these toxicities.
That becomes a very important point. I think one of the things we've seen with some of the randomized studies where bosutinib has been the control drug, that coming in with a full dose has resulted in major discontinuations in the drug early.
Yeah.
And resulting discussion being it's inferior medication. So I think it hasn't really been given a fair assessment for that regard. So I think there's also that data referring to some of the studies you commented on, that there's been no difference in efficacy whether a patient went on full dose or whether they ramped up. So you're not impacting how effective your drug is by doing that and really reducing some of the toxicities. And I think that's a big deal. I think the diarrhea, let's be frank, is what has discouraged many of our colleagues from using this drug or scaring patients off as I don't want to have to put up with that. And I think if you can get over that hump, people are more likely going to stay on it and more likely going to try it. And if we can assure our colleagues that by doing that, the drug becomes much more manageable in terms of usage, it would be wonderful.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, that initial one and then educating the patient and helping them, you know, understand the impact of the diarrhea. I also use diarrhea medication, Imodium, Lamotil, you know, I make it available to my patients and let them know that, you know, if they're going to be on a situation where they not have easy access to a bathroom and I don't know, you're traveling, you use it as needed. Most patients don't need it, but I think just the fact that they can have a little bit more control, also because, as I mentioned, the diarrhea tends to happen shortly after they take the medication. If you explain that, then they can start doing their scheduling, you know, do it at night when they're back home after work or something that, you know, make it fit into their schedule. And I think when you do those things between the education, the ramping up, the management, diarrhea tends to be very, very manageable.
Regarding discontinuation compliance, one of the biggest issues I always found with imatinib patients who are having diarrhea, I'm coming to clinic, I have to take the bus, there's no bathrooms, yeah. I don't take my imatinib that morning. I have to go shopping that morning or to the hairdresser or to the barber or something else, I don't take my imatinib that morning.
Yeah.
And that's had a major impact on compliance. I think some of the things we've seen with bosentinib, we can get around that.
Right, yeah, I agree.
Is there any side effects that you would necessarily discontinue?
Diarrhea, I very rarely discontinue because of diarrhea. I think one that most, even though it's a small minority, but it's the one that has made me discontinue bosutinib the most has been liver toxicity, elevation of liver function tests, you know, transaminases. You know, I manage it. You know, when I see those things, if it's a grade 3, grade 4, I stop, I adjust the doses. Most of them respond well to a dose adjustment. There are the occasional ones where you just have to change to a different drug. It's probably, you know, 5% of patients, so it's a small minority. But that's perhaps the one that I find a bit more challenging when it becomes recurrent but I still always give it an attempt at managing with dose adjustments because most of the time that works. It just when you're down to the lowest dose that gives you benefit and it's not working, well, then I change.
Hey, remember, the lowest dose may be as low as 200 milligrams a day, which some of the studies have shown. And I think people need to remember, particularly those of us who work in really cosmopolitan areas with patients from all over the world, there tends to be an ethnic or a racial difference in the doses that people can handle.
Mm-hmm.
Asians, for instance, will handle much lower doses. And it's rare for me to have an Asian patient where I go above 300 milligrams and they get a really great efficacy. So I think you need to keep this in mind that not all of us are made the same way. And that's something we need to take that into account. Long-term subjects, I agree with you there. You know, if you can't rid of the liver problems, or the rare, very rare, bosutinib patients who may have some of the dasatinib-related issues like recurrent pleural effusions, which you can get, and particularly in the group of patients who are bosutinib after dasatinib, or now there's one or two cases of pulmonary hypertension reported with dasatinib, like one or two cases over hundreds and hundreds of patients, I think are rare events, but I think in the long run, I would watch for increases in blood pressure would probably be the only other thing that I think needs to be monitored for, but definitely wouldn't drive me to discontinue the drug, but rather to treat it. But that's like all TKIs, is they will have these comorbidities develop either because of age or other things, and they've got to be monitored and managed. And whether we do it, those of us treating the CML, or we have colleagues or specialists or primary care decisions to it, we just have to make sure someone is following it and monitoring it.
Yeah, I agree.
I guess we've talked about some of the other issues, and there really aren't a lot that you can control with, as you said, dose reductions. And that's a very, very common problem. You know, and the regular blood work and physical monitoring is necessary, and you monitor the same way for molecular changes the same way as everything else. Mm-hmm. I think the one point we should probably comment is treatment-free remission. There is no randomized study with bosutinib. However, given that it's so similar to the other second-generation drugs, I would tend to think of it much the same way as I would think nilotinib or dasatinib in terms of that. You know, if you're going to try it, the same indications as for all the other drugs, and close monitoring for recurrence. But I think it's much the same way. But I don't think we're ever going to see a discontinuation study with bosutinib. But there are people stopping it. So I think if you're going to put that into your armamentarium, do it the right way.
Yeah, I agree. And you mentioned it, there's no studies. But I think we all have patients here and there that we've stopped bosutinib following the same guidelines as we do with the other TKIs. And the expected outcomes are the same. So definitely something that can be attempted and that should be considered for patients should be discussed from with patients from the beginning, and you know, aim for the same goals, so that patients can have that opportunity if that's what they choose to do.
I'm not sure if there's anything else you want to add, but I think we can summarize really by saying that bosutinib is at least as effective as any of the other drugs that are out there, second generation, may have an opportunity in some individuals, particularly if they're going on to third line because of intolerance, to give it a try because there's some good data there. Treatment-free remission should be considered in the same way as all the other drugs. But I think the most important thing is, I think colleagues should not necessarily be afraid of the drug because they might have heard of what they've read. There are ways to get patients through that initial brief hump that they may have some side effects, and to get them onto a drug that generally in the long term is very easily tolerated. Patients have good quality of life and is extremely effective for the long term. I think we don't want to necessarily focus on the product monograph dosing. We may be able to use doses less than that, but that we're finding may be true with all TKIs at this time, as we're generally going down in many of these drugs. But I think we have a good drug that can be used safely. And with that, I've got nothing else I would like to add.
No, I think you summarized it well. I may just, well, probably just word it a little bit different as well. You know, when we're looking at the long-term, the risk-benefit, I always think about the side effects in terms of the ones that are frequent but not as serious, and the ones that are more serious, they may not be as frequent. I am a lot more worried about cardiovascular risks and cardiovascular side effects and pleural effusions and pulmonary hypertension and those kind of things. And particularly that long term, those things continue to happening. They're not an early phenomenon. They tend to continue occurring over time. And that is where I see bosutinib having a significant benefit. You know, yes, you do have a high rate of early diarrhea, but we talked already that it's highly manageable and it has even a relatively lesser impact on quality of life. I worry a lot more because my patients are going to be on long-term treatment about arterial occlusive events and pleural effusions and pulmonary hypertension and all these things. And that is where I think that the risk-benefit value of bosutinib is very advantageous for patients. And that's why it's a drug that I think deserves consideration in most patients. You know, they fortunately, we do have many options, and that's a good thing. But I find bosutinib a very valuable drug in my practice.
I think you make a very good point. And really, the gold standard that we all look for and we all hope for is treatment-free remission. But basically, if you start with a number of patients, not all of them are eligible. Mm-hmm. Not everybody wants to stop their drug. And even those who stop, about anywhere from 40 to 50% are going to recur, depending on the drug. The bottom line of that is the majority of our patients are actually going to remain on the drug indefinitely,
right,
until we come up with some other mechanism and maybe able to get around that recurrence rate. So I think the fact that you've got someone on an drug indefinitely and you've got the lowest number really of serious chronic side effects, as you just pointed out, I think is extremely important. That makes bosutinib a very good drug, even in cases where they may have been in another drug and you want to switch them to a safer drug for long-term use from a safety point of view.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think that finishes what we would like to do. I would sincerely like to thank my close friend and colleague, Dr. Jorge Cortez, for participating with me in this discussion. I know most of people know about the efficacy of bosutinib, and I now hope with this discussion, it will help them with using the drug in a safer manner to keep patients on it and increase the use of the drug. Thank you.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.